Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I think you probably have been impressed, as have I, by the uncommon intelligence of our first guest. His name is Robert Charles. You've heard him frequently on this program. You see him regularly at Fox and elsewhere. He's a former Assistant Secretary of State during the George W. Bush administration. He also served in the George H.W. Bush administration and in the Reagan administration in the White House. He is these days, among other things, a practicing attorney and an author. Author! He is indeed the author of Eagles and Evergreens, which I'm very pleased to say is a terrific read. Welcome back, Robert. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Always glad to be here.
So, as a man who has served in senior reaches of the U.S. government, as well as an attorney, as a professor, I believe, at Harvard Law School, if I'm not mistaken, along the trail, I have the feeling that you have given considerable thought to, well, in fact, I know you have. I've seen you and talked to you about it, the transformation of Judge Kavanaugh to Justice Kavanaugh, now seated, I'm happy to say, on the Supreme Court of the United States. I'm interested in both your thoughts on his prospects now that he is on that particular bench, but also what he went through to get there and what it says about the state of our polity.
Well, I appreciate it, Frank. And I have to say, with all your listeners, I think I was sickened by what I watched occur in the United States Senate. And of all committees, the Judiciary Committee, which is supposed to be the judicious committee, I've never seen anything quite like what that spectacle amounted to. I've heard it described by a lot of people as a circus, and even a circus has a certain degree of order and expectation to it that missed there. Kavanaugh was a clerk, obviously, many, many moons ago for Justice Kennedy, and in many ways, he is the living embodiment of a great replacement for Justice Kennedy. He is he's the kind of conservative who he's a bit more conservative on social issues, but reality is he follows the law where the law takes him. And I just have to say my hat is off to him, as it is incidentally to Lindsey Graham for having defended him and to Susan Collins, because what you are witnessing here is the breakdown of the regular order. They tried, I'll call it a coalition of leftists and some of them well-paid leftist activists really sought to undermine and derail the democratic process. I've never seen anything quite like it, and I hope he has a calm next 40 years in which he hands down thoughtful, as he always has, opinions and follows in the tradition of the Supreme Court, which I'm sure he will. My bigger concern right now, I think, is for the public safety generally of people involved in this kind of process, as well as for the Supreme Court members, as well as for some of the people who speak out. I mean, the fact that Susan Collins can have given a Margaret Chase Smith type speech and then be subject to threats of violence, and there have been threats of violence against Senator Cotton, and you've got Maxine Waters out there threatening people. I think it's a sad, but it's more than sad. It's a very dangerous route when a democracy believes that it's going to that it can somehow safely turn toward violence. And I'm thinking, quite honestly, Frank, of the French Revolution. Danton was the guy that started out saying, let's just be violent for a little while. And then what happened in the end? He and his 12 comrades were all, you know, killed by the very people.
Yeah. I really wanted to drill down for just a moment on this incident involving Susan Collins. It's seared in my mind. I'm sure you've seen it, and I think probably most in our audience have as well, this sort of frozen frame as she was stuck in an elevator, I believe in the U.S. Capitol, and there were people screaming at her at the top of their lungs. She had a couple of large fellows between the two of them, but she was clearly very shaken by it. And, you know, couldn't go anywhere. And unfortunately, as you say, Robert Charles, this is not an isolated incident now. In fact, some have had a bit worse of it, notably Senator Rand Paul, who's actually been physically attacked on a couple of occasions. This does, it seemed to me, engender, as you said, a sense that things are sliding into a very volatile and very ominous mix, where we'll be talking later in the program with Diana West, who has a wonderful turn of phrase for this sort of situation in which we find ourselves. She wrote a book about it many years ago called Death of the Grown-Up, and it certainly seems as though there's an absence of grown-ups. Let me ask you about specifically what the prospects for our republic are if we can't get a grip here, if particularly Democratic leaders and elected officials can't tell their base, which has clearly been whipped into a frenzy, to stand down and grow up and get a grip. Is this really a situation in which representative government is imperiled?
Well, Frank, this is the test. This is the test of any democracy. And what I have witnessed here, just what we've all Americans have witnessed here in the last month, is a dangerous tip in the direction of indulging this kind of reckless talk. And reckless talk leads, unfortunately, often to reckless action. I mentioned Danton earlier because, as a student of history, and I know you are, people forget how truly delicate ordered government, and particularly democracy, is. It's a fragile plant, often in a stiff wind. And you have to remember that in order to participate and make a republic work, there has to be a respect for difference of opinion. It is essential. It is, in fact, at the very heart of the thing. And if for people who don't believe that, go read things like Miracle at Philadelphia, which is the composite of all of Madison's notes at the Constitutional Convention. People are allowed to change their minds in the pursuit of truth. We're forgetting that that's what democracy is about. And my fear, and I see it coming into the midterms now, is that the Democrats have kind of become all out, or at least the left wing of the Democrats, which seems to be swallowing their party, have become all out in the notion that certain things are justifiable and whatever it takes to get to them, including violence, will somehow be permissible. That's not who we are as Americans. It's not who Harry Truman was. It's not who Franklin Roosevelt was. It's not who Ronald Reagan was. It's not who Theodore Roosevelt was. And it shouldn't be who we are. You know, the notion that in these midterms, you can advocate, which is really the Democratic platform now, for kind of a victimization of all white males by accusation, multiple impeachments now as their primary driver, a rollback of the individual liberty tied to tax cuts, kind of a deflection or disinterest in national security, more mandates for the individual, and politicizing our institutions. That's a pretty dangerous agenda. And at the end of the day, when you politicize the Supreme Court, as Justice Kavanaugh now said so beautifully in an op-ed recently this week, the Supreme Court is the last arbiter or the last line of defense for the separation of powers. And when you politicize that organization, what you've done, that's the death knell of rule of law.
We have to leave it at that for the moment. But Robert Charles, we will look forward to having you back soon. Thank you for today's visit, and as well as your cumulative service to our country. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, Mike Griffin, about hypersonic threats to our nation and what we must do about them in space and elsewhere to keep you safe. That and much more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is my great privilege to have known for quite some time now a man who has served his country in a variety of capacities with great distinction. In the defense sector, notably in the Defense Department's Missile Defense Agency, it's been called different things at different times. He has served as the director of NASA, and he is these days the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, the man who presides over the incredibly arduous job of ensuring that our military is capable of dealing with all enemies, with all their capabilities, present and prospective. He is an extraordinary public servant, and it is a real honor to have him with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Mr. Secretary, welcome. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Yes, we have known one another for a long time. I hope always to mutual benefit.
It's certainly been my honor. Listen, I wanted to just set the stage for a brief conversation with you about our national security posture by reminding our audience of what has been going on in recent weeks between the Russians and Chinese in something they call Vostok 18, which, as you know, is a major exercise and apparently has involved simulated nuclear attacks on the United States. I won't ask you to get into classified assessments of this, but what does it tell you about the seriousness of the threat we're facing?
Well, it confirms for me what our, one more time, if such confirmation were needed, it confirms for me the wisdom of the National Defense Strategy that was released in January of this year. It's the first really new national defense strategy that I think we've had since the Reagan era, to be honest. Possibly the first new such strategy that we really needed since that time. But the published strategy calls out at the unclassified level a renewal of an era of great power competition that, frankly, the United States has not had to face since the wall came down and the Soviet Union broke up.
Or we've faced, but it's been emerging to a point where it didn't seem as serious a problem as it certainly does now in either Russia or China.
For those of us like yourself and myself who are, I guess I would say, inherently skeptical and suspicious, yes, we've been watching this emerge for a while, but now it has emerged full blown. And so when Russia and China are combining to war game how we would attack the U.S. and attack U.S. interests around the world, you know, at some point you kind of have to take that seriously.
Right. Well, we're at that point, and thank God you're among those in the Pentagon that are there to take seriously this threat and to act on the strategy for dealing with it. Which brings me to a presentation that you and your counterpart on the policy side of the Pentagon, Undersecretary of Defense John Rood, and Lieutenant General Sam Greaves in the Missile Defense Agency convened on Capitol Hill recently under the auspices of the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. It was a fascinating presentation, and I wanted to commend you in particular because I think what you were saying about this strategic environment we're in, including some of the capabilities that the Russians and the Chinese are now beginning to bring to bear, really put a very fine point on the magnitude of this problem. Could you just recap quickly both the hypersonic and maneuvering threat piece of this and what we need to be doing about it?
Well, one of the things that I pointed out or that someone pointed out at the conference and that I picked up on and amplified upon was that the Chinese have developed and the Russians are developing a hypersonic maneuvering vehicle threat that is at present, I think it is being considered to be tactical rather than strategic in nature, meaning conventional rather than nuclear, and confined to relatively limited theaters, but which is strategic in its implications. Because these systems overfly our air defense capability. They operate at many tens of kilometers in altitude, and they underfly our missile defense capabilities because they never really go much above 100 kilometers of altitude. And when they do, it's in the immediate post-boost phase when they're over their own territory and our ground-based missile defenses don't reach them. So they've crafted a system which flies in the niches in our defensive systems, and as they approach their targets, which may be forward operating bases or westward islands such as Guam and other places or aircraft carriers, when they approach those targets, they're capable of very high acceleration maneuvers, and the conventional interceptors with which we are equipped won't be able to get after it.
Yeah. And you actually said, essentially, we have to be in space, a domain in which you have spent much of your professional career thinking about and building programs and demonstrating capabilities. Talk a little bit about, in the context, I guess, of the Space Force, among other things, what you have in mind there, Secretary Mike Griffin.
Well, what we talked about in that context with regard to space was that we, because of the reasons I just stated, their advanced maneuverability when they're close to their target, these things have a cruise phase which can last several thousand kilometers or, you know, tens of minutes. That is where they are vulnerable, but they are not within range of our vision at those points.
From the ground or, you know, the atmosphere.
Right. So the only practical way to target them, to track them, is from space. You know, we simply don't have enough radars far enough forward positioned to be able to track these things in the usual case. And so, as you know, the Congress in its recent authorization bill has required that the department begin development of a space sensor layer, and the president has signed the bill, so it is a law. So we will be looking at what kind of space sensor layer allows us to detect, acquire, track, target, and provide fire control for these kinds of threats.
Yeah. And I think it was you who mentioned this, but it's worth stating explicitly, at least for the moment, and I think that caveat was also said, there is a bipartisan consensus about the need for this kind of defensive capability that is, if not unprecedented, certainly doesn't come to my mind in the 40 or so years that I've been fooling around with this stuff, and you have too. How important is that to doing what you need to do, Mr. Secretary, in terms of translating technology and capabilities in the abstract into actual defenses that we need so urgently?
Well, I mean, it's critical. I was making the comment in our conference on the Hill the other day that in my working career, you know, now well over 45 years, that I've never seen the Hill so lined up in support of what we believe to be needed to defend our nation. And it's very encouraging. Let me offer praise not only for the strategy behind the National Defense Authorization Act, but you'll note that we have an on-time, regular order appropriations bill this year to go with all that. It's been a very long time since we've had that kind of strategic thinking captured in an authorization act and followed up by appropriations. I'm truly grateful to them.
I thought you captured this thought brilliantly in a very shorthand way when you said an explanation for why this seemingly almost unprecedented turnabout had taken place on the Hill. I think you said the enemy voted. Just talk us through that for a moment. Is it the case that the threat is now so apparent to even people who don't like missile defense and don't like space-based missile defense in particular that it cannot be ignored?
Yeah, the threat is apparent. It's a little bit slangy to say the threat has voted, which is a clever way to put it. But the way that I like to put it is the United States never declares other people to be its adversaries first. Other people declare us to be their adversary. And then we have to respond or we don't respond. I vote for responding, but it's not the United States which is going after Russia and going after China. And, you know, I commented in that meeting the other day, we did all of the background research on hypersonic systems. We never chose to weaponize them. They are choosing, have chosen to weaponize them, and we have to respond. The United States would just as soon not have people declaring themselves to be our adversaries, but we don't get the choice.
Right. But this raises one last question, if I may, Mr. Secretary. And again, our guest is Mike Griffin, the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. We do have a problem, as you know better than anybody, with the technology that our brilliant scientists and engineers are developing being ripped off and being brought to bear against us, in some cases, before we can even bring it to bear in our own defense. Just very quickly, two questions. Compare and contrast, if you will, the readiness and the capacity of our industrial base to support our necessary defense needs and the extent to which our adversaries are more than performing in terms of creating these threats or translating our capabilities into new threats against us?
Well, our industrial base is the best in the world, with no one even in second place when it comes to producing sophisticated weapons at scale. What we are, and this is a combination of a government industry problem, what we are not as good at as we used to be is producing things quickly, doing our design cycles quickly, making decisions quickly, and getting things in the field. We are, I think I mentioned the other day, we are running at, delivery times of 15 and 16 years after statement of need. That just doesn't match the threat. That's what we have to work on.
Well, and it is so encouraging that a man of your talent is working on it and working on behalf of all of us. I thank you for your continuing public service, Undersecretary of Defense Mike Griffin, and it is inspiring to know that what you're trying to do is bearing fruit, especially in some of these areas that I think are absolutely critical to the deterring of our adversaries and the defending of our nation. So thank you again for your service, sir. Come back to us again if you would.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we are joined, as we are each week, by a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, Kevin Freeman. He happens also to be one of the world's great authorities on matters involving economic warfare, which is not only the subject of his terrific blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com, but also his new television production, which is now on CRTV, I'm very pleased to say. It rolled out last week. It is Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Check it out, folks. Kevin, it's good to have you back, and congratulations on the new program.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, let's talk about something that you cover a lot, I know, in your various outlets. You've focused on it as well in places like your two books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, as well. And that is, what are the communist Chinese up to? And I happened to catch this morning on another radio network, NPR, the storyline was that the Chinese takeover of a Greek port known as Piraeus has gotten people increasingly concerned, both in Greece and elsewhere in Europe. This is part of the Belt and Road Initiative, of course, and arguably was the kickoff of it, a major foothold in Europe. They now are said to control 10% of that continent's ports. Talk a little bit about, Kevin, what that might mean from an economic warfare point of view.
Well, as you know, Frank, the Belt and Road Initiative is a massive debt entrapment project. It is China using their economic clout, promise of opening of their markets or their specific investments to literally take control, sometimes complete ownership of the infrastructure of the world. And they have done this in Asia, they've done this in Africa, they've done this in Latin America, and they're doing it in Europe through Greece. So they look for the weak nations' economies and opportunities where they can come in and befriend, but what they're really doing is getting them addicted to Chinese control. And the Chinese promise a lot of things, but in the end, they wind up either, as they have in the Panama Canal, they have both ends of the Panama Canal, and in the ports in Greece, it's the same thing. They want to control global commerce. This is what communist nations do. They want it's a command and control economy.
Well, it's only one of the angles of attack as they go after our interests and even our personal interests in this country. Kevin, talk a little bit about this revelation that the Chinese have placed tiny chips in phones that they've been manufacturing for Americans, among other consumers, and what that might portend.
Well, this is a nightmare for consumers around the world. It's a nightmare for technology companies in particular. The Chinese manufacture semiconductors, and on those semiconductors are chips within chips. And Bloomberg did a huge story that was well-researched, lots of sources that suggested that chips that are sold all around the world, the chips that are bought by Apple Computer included, contain these back doors that could be turned on, and the Chinese could ultimately control what Amazon is doing, what Apple's doing. It goes into servers, it goes into the cloud. And so they've placed these little spies, in essence, in all of our electronics. Now, Apple has disputed it. Supermicro, the company that produces these, has disputed it. But the reality of it is, we know that that's their intention. It's a part of their doctrine. And Apple, in the past, you know, they'd say, oh, our phones don't bend. And then, you know, they'd find that the phones bent and they had a recall and they fixed them. And that, oh, we don't have any problems in our software. And then they'd have an upgrade or an update.
Yeah. Really a chilling thought, but evidence of the kind of sophistication of the Chinese and their determination to engage in the high-tech theft of everything, including our military secrets, of course.
Well, and that goes into military chips, too. The Pentagon has bought a bunch of these. And so we are very vulnerable to a disrupted IT supply chain because we cannot trust Chinese production of IT equipment.
Yeah. Well, and this is, of course, compounded by what ZTE and Huawei do every day as well. Kevin, let me turn to another area of concern with the Chinese, actually several. Their currency continues to plummet. That has implications for us, of course. They are reducing the amount of money that their banks are supposed to hold in reserves. Evidently, they're engaged in, among other things, rather cynical dodges to work around the tariffs that President Trump has been imposing on them. Give us a sense of the importance of each of these ideas and initiatives.
Well, the reality of it is that when you're losing a trade war, these are the tactics that you have to take. You have to lower the value of your currency for trade so that your goods continue to gain market share or to maintain market share in spite of the tariffs that have been placed. And so they've been manipulating the currency. And they've been currency manipulators for several decades. This is a part of their playbook. They don't let the free market control the value of their currency. They manipulate it. And likewise, their economy has been slowing, and so they've had the lower reserve requirements. They're essentially printing money. This would be a lax or loose monetary policy because their economy is slowing, and they're admitting that it's slowing, and they're actually taking measures, which means we're winning the trade war because, it's quite frankly, they were cheating. And when we eliminate their ability to cheat and that natural advantage it gives them, it causes them to compete more fairly, and they're not competing as well as they had hoped they would.
Mm. And with respect to the bank reserves, Kevin, is that of concern to you as an economic warrior? Is this likely putting us in greater jeopardy of, you know, defaults or other actions on their part that might have ripple effects through the global economy, for that matter?
There will be ripple effects. The reality is the Chinese economy is in part, and our friend Gordon Chang has pointed this out well, in part smoke and mirrors. They have been manipulating their economy in a way, and there's always a price to pay from that, and the price is coming. And so the fact that they're altering the reserves, they're just trying to pump up the monetary system, but there is damage that will be incurred down the road. Hopefully we can be insulated from that. Hopefully our economic growth, you know, our economy is growing much more rapidly under President Trump than it did the preceding previous 10 years. And their economy is growing much more slowly than it did under the Obama administration and during that. So we're actually seeing a net positive effect. Now, there will be a price to pay at some point when we realize the smoke and mirrors and all of the investment that we've placed in China that really isn't there to the degree that we'd wanted it to be, or hope that the opening of their markets has not happened and so forth. So yes, there will be a price to pay, and it is potentially very dangerous to the global economy because we put so many eggs in that basket. But hopefully our growth can offset some of that.
Well, we are going to be watching closely, and nobody's doing it more than you, whether there are steps taken by the Chinese that will rather directly impact that strong U.S. economy and perhaps do so during this October window, the so-called October surprise, to the detriment of President Trump and his party. Kevin, let me turn lastly to one other story. There is a report that there's a very acrimonious debate underway at the moment within the Trump administration about the president's policy towards Iran, with Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin once again at odds with the president, it seems, specifically pushing very hard to allow the Iranians to remain in the so-called SWIFT system, which would clearly be a problem if you're trying to actually impose meaningful sanctions on them. First of all, remind us what SWIFT is, and second, what do you think the president is likely to do in the face of this pressure?
Well, the SWIFT system is the interbank transaction system. So if you want to do a transaction between U.S. dollars and British pounds, it goes through the SWIFT system. And it's the means by which we have enforced sanctions. We cut people off with access to the dollar, and we say you can't transact in dollars, we'll fine you, and so forth. Russia, China, and others have been developing an alternative because they realize that with the SWIFT system as the only real means of exchange between nations, that we have control over all international transactions. And so they've been building an alternative to it. The Treasury Secretary is likely concerned, and rightly so, that if we continue to impose sanctions and use this dollar as a weapon, that other nations will find means of doing transactions around it, and we will lose control. The reality of it is that ship sailed long ago, and we have to use what we have as means and capabilities. The SWIFT system will be at some point challenged and possibly replaced. Right now, Russia is trying to build that, and China already has built a version of it. And there are nations that plan to stop using the dollar as reserve currency. The answer to it is to be a strong nation. The answer is to continue to grow our economy and be the business partner everyone wants to deal with. Who would want to deal with Iran versus dealing with America? We need to make that case forcefully in the world. We can continue to have economic leadership, and it does not mean that we have to give up our righteous and moral stand on, look, Iran, you are violating all of these international norms, including a terror attack in Europe that they'd planned and almost pulled off. We should not be doing business with you. We should use the tools we have to isolate them. I believe the president's right rather than the Treasury Secretary.
Well, this is very important, and I hope we, in fact, will stay the course. The president, I think, has this exactly right, and the best thing that can happen, it seems to me, is for this set of sanctions to be absolutely crippling to this Iranian regime and help catalyze its termination at the hands of its own people. And if that happens, I think we're going to see an awful lot of other things with the Chinese and the Russians and those who would undermine us on SWIFT and in these other institutional ways changing for the better. Kevin, thank you so much for your time today, my friend. And again, congratulations on the rollout of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Next up, we will speak with Diana West straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by one of our dear friends and great contributors here at Secure Freedom Radio, Diana West. She is, of course, a syndicated columnist. She's been for many years these days, is writing for the Daily Caller. And also, of course, you can find her writings at dianawest.net. But we also want to take stock with her of some of the things she's been writing about in longer form, specifically her two terrific books, The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization, and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana West, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
So, it seems to me, Diana, we've spoken earlier in the program about what went down with Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation proceedings, happily now concluded, his installation complete on the Supreme Court. But I can't think really of a more apt way of describing what the Democrats and their allies engaged in than really a case study in the death of grown-ups. Talk a little bit about both, you know, the insights that you laid out in your book and how they are on display at the moment with respect to the so-called loyal opposition in America.
Yes, well, I think this is indeed a case study in the death of a grown-up, which is the way I think about the cultural trajectory down that we've watched really over the past 75 years, let's say, but certainly in the aftermath of World War II, when all of a sudden young people, children even, were a tremendously important force in the marketplace and in the schools, which were suddenly becoming quite large. High schools for the first time were, the ratio of students to adults to teachers was suddenly becoming enormous as giant high schools became the way. We saw the incursion, if you will, of a child-centered way of teaching taking hold.
And by child-centered, that doesn't sound necessarily to be a bad thing. It's having the children tell us what they will learn.
Well, the paradigm shifted from children learning information and facts and memorizing history and learning grammar and things like that that are difficult and tedious at times, many times, to being but necessary to this other way of learning, which really was child-centered, child-directed is probably a better term. And these facts were no longer being taught. And over time, we also see the inculcation of attitudes and feelings replacing the traditional study.
Yeah, even with respect to math, as I understand it, which is kind of hard to get your head around.
And it actually does get quite nefarious when you do realize that this becomes a purposeful way of changing the American population through all kinds of thought conditioning and controls, which do have Soviet models. Yes, it's true. So this really does come to fruition in when we see supposedly a political party, a mainstream political party dominated by people who seem completely impervious to logic, fact, law and order, the basic concept.
Civility, conduct in public, and all the rest. Yeah, it's a kind of infantilism, isn't it? But also one that reflects the indulgence of a society in this kind of behavior, which only makes it more likely to occur and in worse forms yet, in all likelihood.
There's one thing I'd like to add about that, because when we go to the absolutely bizarre now historical fact that the U.S. Senate was actually combing through high school yearbooks from the 1980s, I think that those yearbooks in Washington, among the Washington elite schools, Holton Arms, Georgetown Prep, but particularly Holton Arms, which I did have some time to study as they went online, you do see there what the result of a world without grown-ups is, the effect of it on the children. These were teenagers. And if you actually look at the drinking and partying that was sanctioned by Holton Arms, and I say that because the tales of this wild partying life of these teenage girls was published in the official yearbook of the school.
Just another extracurricular activity.
That meant it was approved by the administration. Now, I went to the high school at a prep school in the 1980s, and we had a very different kind of administration, even though this was what you would call a Hollywood high school, a Hollywood prep school. But we had a very much an adult administration. These kids did not, and they were ill-served by it. And I would just maintain that that is some big part of the story. The adults were not home in the 1980s for these Holton Arms girls, and it's a shame, you know, but it's part of the same story.
And it may well be part of the psychological profile that we've been watching play out here with Dr. Ford, among others. Diana, I do want to switch gears because we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about, and we're going to have you back soon to do a full hour of conversation on all of these topics. Thank you for agreeing to do that. But second, I'd like to turn to your other book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, because as we've been discussing in recent weeks, what is playing out now with respect to the unfolding scandal of the FBI, most especially, but other elements of the so-called deep, or I think of it as counter state. Your book talks about subversion aimed at overthrowing the government of the United States at the hands of people who worked for it for year after year, decade after decade. Is that what we're watching now? Just to pick one example out of many one could think of, this fellow James Baker, the former general counsel of the FBI, seems to be featuring more and more prominently in matters involving James Comey and Andrew McCabe and, of course, Peter Strzok and now Rod Rosenstein. Talk a little bit about what Mr. Baker was up to and what it says about the larger problem of the deep state at work.
Yes, well, if we just take the quick historical overview, we know that the State Department was deeply penetrated, for example, by the 1940s by Soviet agents, that we had our policymaking mechanisms compromised. What we're looking at today is something that's actually scarier in a sense, because it has such a stark and frightening domestic application, and that would be the compromising or the corruption of our FBI and Justice Department, which back in the day, we could look at the FBI, which was investigating, for example, the State Department incursions by communists and KGB agents and pro-communists, etc. They were still pretty tough, pretty anti-communist, and you could depend on the G-men to be doing the work of the American people in trying to uncover this kind of subversion. Well, what we're learning now over these many months is that this mechanism, this safety feature of our security is absolutely compromised. And James Baker really offers a strong example here, because we are seeing him as a sort of point of entry for a lot of the anti-Trump conspiratorial movements. I was really struck by just a little factoid, really, that David Korn of Mother Jones was in communication with the general counsel of the FBI before the election. Now, that's a strange sort of extracurricular activity for a general counsel. I mean, this is not even a public relations person or, you know, it's somebody that seems very removed.
Yeah, remind us what Mother Jones is.
Well, that's the thing. People forget, and it's very easy to, because I think part of what's happened over these many years is we've lost our whole concept of counterintelligence or really survival instinct. Mother Jones was named for a real Mother Jones, who was a radical anti-capitalist co-founder of the IWW, a radical left socialist organization. She was a Socialist Party member, and the magazine itself has won and displays on its website with pride two awards for journalism called Izzy. The Izzy is a journalism award named for a Soviet agent who was a famous journalist named I.F. Stone. And so when you think about that, and you think about the FBI general counsel sitting down with this person, it really is a topsy-turvy world. There's something wrong with this picture, and it does go to the subversion of the institution. And what we further found out, this just maybe today, but certainly this week from the remarkable John Solomon, is that no, David Korn did not get the information, as he has been saying, about the dossier from James Baker. Korn was a source for James Baker.
This is, of course, the Steele dossier, the dodgy dossier that has been used to frame Donald Trump and others. Again, there's just way too much to talk about. We can't do it today, I'm sorry to say, but thank you for your time thus far, and we will have you back very soon. Diana, we'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.